Thank you. Thank you. I can tell you most everybody in Washington has seen Joni Ernst ad. And I can tell you that the purveyors of pork are shaking in their boots and worried that Joni Ernst will come up there. I can also tell you we're going to do everything to make sure that she does come up there. I don't see how Iowa can send us a guy who disparages farming and disparages my friend Chuck Grassley. I don't see how that's going to happen. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not so excited about the president freeing the Taliban. I'm not so excited about the president saying somehow they're no longer a danger. I'm not so excited about Hillary Clinton saying, oh, the Taliban's of no danger to Americans. So I said the other day, I was in Texas, I said, you know, if this president likes to trade so much, we've got that Marine on gun charges down in Mexico, why don't we do a trade? But this time, instead of trading the Taliban, why don't we trade them 5 Democrats? John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi. I can come up with a list. But here's the funny thing about trying to tell a joke when you're in politics. Immediately, the reporters were like, seriously? Did he just compare Democrats to the Taliban? So we had to issue a correction. So we sent out a tweet and we said, just kidding, except for Pelosi. I've got good news and bad news, though, from Washington. The good news is your government's open. The bad news is your government's open and still borrowing $1 million every minute. The debt is spiraling out of control. If you've seen the debtclock.org, just look at the numbers and you'll be frightened for your country and for your kids' future. Some are saying that this burden of debt could cost does cost a million jobs every year. It is literally out of control. But during the shutdown, they sent us a notice and they said, tell us who your essential employees are and who your unessential employees are. And I said, well, we're going to really learn something about government. We're going to learn out where the problems are. This sounds like a good process. Until I discovered that there were 100,000 federal employees that make over $100,000 a year that were declared unessential. And I thought, well, my goodness, that's the bulk of the government. That maybe we could have a smaller government. But now this is Washington. I discovered that there's a trick. If you're declared unessential, you don't have to show up for work during a shutdown, but you're still paid. Only in Washington could you shut the government down and it costs more than keeping it open. Completely insane. But I asked for a report from my staff. I said, well, what did the IRS say? Essential, unessential? 90% unessential. What did the EPA say? 95% unessential. I said, we're getting somewhere here. Maybe we're going to learn something. And then they actually went through some of the EPA employees. One woman had not been to work in 20 years. She had had no contact, no email for 5 years. And you say, well, good, we found now she's been fired. No, you don't get it. She's a federal employee. We can't even fire the people at the VA who have lied to us about our veterans, made up these lists, and allowed veterans to wait in a line and die. We can't fire them. This is how dysfunctional your government is. They discovered another woman at the EPA who was selling jewelry and vitamins from her computer and had employed 17 paid interns that were family members of hers. They found another guy had been downloading porn for 6 hours a day. And you think, well, certainly he was fired. He still works for the EPA. It's a disgrace. But my favorite is they found a guy named Jonathan Beal. He'd been working at the EPA for 11 years. He was Gina McCarthy's right-hand man. And they looked, and he always was getting raises. He always got performance bonuses. His reviews were good. But they noticed he hadn't been to work in 6 months. So they asked his boss. They did something really extraordinary. They actually followed up and asked his boss, and they said, oh, well, the reason he's not here very often, he's also a CIA agent. And they were like, really? He works for the EPA and the CIA. Kind of an interesting combination. But then they did something extraordinary. They called the CIA, and they said, Jonathan, who? Turns out he had never worked for the CIA, but I imagine this guy makes $150,000 a year sitting at his apartment or his house next to the pool with a beer, and he's like, his boss calls and says, are you coming in? He's like, no, I'm in Istanbul on secret assignment. This is where your government is. It's completely crazy and completely out of control. So we went through this shutdown, and you said, well, I guess that was terrible. All of the government shut down, right? No. Two-thirds of your government's on autopilot. Two-thirds of your government is mandatory spending and never shuts down. This is Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. So a third of your government is national defense and the other stuff we spend money on. So we did the right thing. We said, you know, we should pay our soldiers. We can't just have our soldiers in the field and not pay them. So we opened up the military and we paid for the military. So now we're down to a sixth of government. About 16% was closed. You would have thought the world was ending and the sky was falling from all the talk from the establishment media. The president, though, was afraid you might not notice. So you remember what the president did? He wrapped the World War II monument. No telling how many employees it takes to wrap the World War II monument. There is no entrance. There is no exit. Nobody works at the World War II monument. But he wanted to make sure you knew that you were going to pay a penalty if you messed with him. If you mess with the president, try to negotiate. He says, I'm not negotiating. I'm not going to negotiate. So he wraps the World War II monument. But if you want an image to remember from the confrontation, from the shutdown, from trying to get the president to do the responsible thing, if you want an image to remember, you remember the World War II veterans cutting the placards, cutting the barricades, and throwing them on the lawn at the White House. The Democrats and the presidents, they say, woe is me, where would we cut? We can't find anywhere to cut. So I've been pointing out a few things and a few areas where he might consider it. We spent $1.8 million last year on roll-up beef jerky. We spent $5 million studying the collective action of fish. We spent $500,000 developing a menu for Mars. Now, this is a good job. If you've got a 26-year-old kid who can't find a job and you're looking for a job, this is a great job. Pays $5,000 stipend, 2 weeks all expenses paid in Hawaii. The prerequisites to get the job are difficult, though. You have to like food. So they sent these 20-something-year-old kids to Hawaii with the assignment to develop a menu. This is a $500,000 study to develop a menu for Mars. And you know what a bunch of college kids came up with? Pizza. We spent $250,000 developing a 3D printer for pizza. So I'm imagining, are we going to be able to get the 3D printer on the Mars module that we're sending? We're going to send a 3D printer to make pizza when we get to Mars. This is your government, the total and complete dysfunctionality of your government. But they say they can't cut anything. But realize two-thirds of the problem are the entitlements. And none of us are saying get rid of that. We're saying reform the entitlements. But here's the disappointing thing, and this is what discourages me about Washington. We had a vote about 4 months ago to try to cut $3 million. Now, some will tell you, $3 million, that's peanuts. Why even bother? Well, if you don't start somewhere, how are we ever going to get started? This was to cut $3 million for Twiggy, the water skiing squirrel. Now, I like dumb pet tricks, and if you email me one, I'll look at it. But I'm not for having the taxpayer spend $3 million for Twiggy the water skiing squirrel to promote the selling of American walnuts in Spain. And God love you if you've got a walnut farm, but that's your job to advertise them, not the taxpayers. But we had a vote, and here's the disturbing thing. That's easy. This should be really easy. The vast majority of Republicans, Americans, Democrats should say, when you have a $1 trillion annual deficit, that we should be able to cut Twiggy the water skiing squirrel. But here's the disappointment. It failed. The majority of Republicans voted to keep the money. And here's the other thing we need to know as Republicans. It's not that we're against a safety net, but we think a safety net should be temporary and the able-bodied should eventually get back to work. But that's tough love. But as Republicans, we can't be out there for what it takes, which is tough love, if we're not willing to stop corporate welfare. We got to stop and end all the welfare to big business. It's crazy. When I think of this administration, I think of old McDonald's farm. Old McDonald's farm of scandals. Here a scandal, there a scandal, everywhere a scandal. But of all the scandals, the one I think that bothers me the most is Benghazi. There's been a lot of discussion of the talking points. And the Democrats say, well, that's political. Well, I'll tell you what's not political. If you are going to consider somebody to be your commander-in-chief, you have to have somebody who will secure the troops, protect the embassies, and who will send reinforcements. The debacle in Benghazi started in the very beginning, at the very top, with Hillary Clinton deciding that the Benghazi consulate was more like Paris than it was Baghdad. It was a war zone, and it was a mistake from the very beginning to have nobody protecting that consulate. Six months in advance of the attack on the consulate, there was a request made of Hillary Clinton for a plane to fly the plane around in case of emergency. Guess what? That emergency did arise, and the night we were looking for reinforcements from Tripoli, do you know what we were doing? We were begging to have the Libyans let us use one of their planes, which was an American plane that we paid for, but we had to beg the Libyans because there was no plane, because the State Department refused to allow a plane to be in Libya to funnel people around the country. This was something that was a terrible and tragic error. But a couple of days after Hillary Clinton's State Department turns down the plane, you know what they have money for? They found $100,000 for a charging station for electric cars at the embassy in Vienna. They found $100,000 to send comedians to India on a Make Chai, Not War tour. We've got enough money for comedians and electric charging stations. They spent $5 million on crystal glassware, but didn't have enough money for security. They spent $650,000 on Facebook ads. Seems they need more friends at the Facebook for the State Department. They spent $700,000 when they didn't say that. They said they didn't have enough for security. They spent $700,000 on landscaping at the embassy in Brussels. So all of this is going on. Meanwhile, Colonel Woods is there with a 16-man personnel team in the middle of August, a month before the attacks, and he says, we need to stay. The British embassy's pulling out. There have been attacks on our consulate, attacks on the British embassy. We need more security, not less. Hillary Clinton's State Department, what do they say? No. So I finally got her in front of my committee on the way out, and I frankly said, look, if I'd have been president, I would have asked for your resignation. And I asked her a question. I said, did you read the cables from the ambassador? She never read them. It's a dereliction of duty. It's something that should preclude Hillary Clinton from ever being considered as commander-in-chief. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. But if you want that to happen, if you want a Republican to be the next president of the United States, we are going to have to be a bigger, better, bolder party. There's a big debate going on, though. Some say for us to be bigger, we have to dilute our message. We need to be Democrat light. We need to be more moderate to get more electoral votes. I couldn't disagree more. In fact, I think the core of our message, we could be even more bold, more honest, more forthright. When Ronald Reagan won a landslide, he ran unabashedly on lowering tax rates for everyone, that it would stimulate the economy, and 20 million jobs were created. That's what we need again. It isn't about being tepid. In Washington, you've got people in Washington say, oh, I'm for revenue neutral tax reform. I frankly, if that's what we're for, I'll go back to being a doctor. I'll go back to Kentucky. I'll continue to yell at the TV. But that's not why I ran for office, to say, oh, Mr. Smith will pay a little more and Mrs. Jones will pay a little less, but the overall tax burden will be the same. Let's be unabashedly for returning more money to Iowa, leaving it here to create jobs. But how do we get bigger and better? I think we don't give up our core message, but part of our message has to reach out to people where they are. So I've spent a lot of time in the last year going to historically black colleges, going to predominantly Hispanic audiences, going to Berkeley, going to places Republicans haven't gone before. But I'm not going there and changing my message. I'm going there with the same message. I spoke to the Conservative Political Action Committee, and I told them, you know what? We're conservatives, and we believe in the Second Amendment, but we also believe in the Fourth Amendment. We also believe in privacy. I took that exact message to Berkeley, and I was received in both places. Young people will vote for us, but it isn't that. You don't meet young people say, oh, I'm not voting for Republican because they're for the balanced budget amendment. You don't meet African Americans say, I'm against the balanced budget amendment. I'm not voting for Republicans. It's just not where they are, particularly young people. They don't have any money. They don't have a job. They don't care about regulations and taxes. But every one of them has a cell phone, and they think, frankly, it's none of the government's business what they do on their cell phone. There are ways we can reach out, but you got to realize where people are. I'll bring up something that may not bring everybody together, just so you can think about it. If you think about the war on drugs, I think drugs are a scourge. I think we've maybe gone too far, that marijuana itself is a problem. And yet, I also think it's a problem to lock people up for 10 and 15 and 20 years for youthful mistakes. If you look at the war on drugs, 3 out of 4 people in prison are black or brown. White kids are doing it too. In fact, if you look at all the surveys, white kids do it just as much as black and brown kids. But the prisons are full of black and brown kids because they don't get a good attorney. They live in poverty. It's easier to arrest them than to go to the suburbs. There's a lot of reasons. But I can tell you, if you go into the African American community and ask them, do you think the law is fair? They'll tell you no. If we're the party of family values, in 1980, there were 200,000 kids with a dad in prison. There's now 2 million. I'm not for saying no laws, but I am saying that, look, most of us are Christians or Jews or of the Judeo-Christian faith, and it's like we believe in redemption. We believe in a second chance. Should a 19-year-old kid get a second chance? I think yes. Let's be the party that has compassion, that doesn't say the behavior's right, but says, you know what? When you're done with your time, that you get to get the right to vote back. Let's be the party that is for extending right to vote back to people who have paid their time, who've reformed their ways. So I say we don't need to dilute our message, but I think if we can take our message or aspects of our message to people where they are, people who live in poverty, the Republican message should be, you know what? We'll come to your town. We'll come to Detroit And we're not going to bring money from Iowa. We're not going to bring money from Kentucky. But we'll so dramatically lower your taxes that it would be a billion-dollar stimulus for Detroit by leaving money in Detroit that originated in Detroit. Then we have something we can offer. But if you're for revenue-neutral tax reform, you're not bringing anything to Detroit. You have to believe that we can have less taxes and smaller government and that that will help create jobs. You got to believe in really what we once believed in. I think if we do that, we'll be the big party again. We'll be the dominant party again. You guys have a strong force here, but frankly, the president won Iowa twice. So we can't do the same old, same old. The definition of insanity is thinking the same thing will get you a different result. The real question we have as a party is we have to decide, can we be true to our purpose, true to our core, true to our message, and figure out how to reach out to people? That's what we have to do. There was a painter by the name of Robert Henri about 100 years ago, and he said to young painters, he said, paint like a man coming over the hill singing. I love the image of that. I think if we could be the party that proclaims our message with the passion of Patrick Henry, but also proclaims our message, our core message that we truly believe, boldly proclaims that message like a man coming over the hill singing, then I think we'll be the dominant party again. I want to be part of that, and I hope you'll help me. Thank you very much.